So this guy calls up and says, I can make crude oil out of wood chips. Can I tell you about it?
And he says, well, all crude oil comes from wood waste, from biomass. It just takes a few million years. I think I can reduce a few million years to a few minutes. I said, oh, wow. Tell me more.
Silicon Valley venture capitalist Vinod Khosla gets pitches like this all the time, putting money where the ideas are, jump-starting energy. Kind of a power trip for The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Friday, February 6th. John is joining us from Los Angeles today on the last day of our series Power Trip, where we've been looking at the future of energy. Good morning, John.
Lots to discuss today on the last day of our Power Trip. Good morning, Adora.
Good morning to everyone. Also, today we get the latest on the very late night for senators who are working through the Obama administration stimulus proposal. Also, we take a look at women in the workforce. And we have some suggestions for things you can do over the weekend, and some of them are free. Those stories are coming up. First, these headlines.
You know, if you ask me, President Obama is starting to sound impatient.
Come on, we are not going to get relief by turning back to the very same policies that for the last 8 years doubled the national debt and threw our economy into a tailspin.
If it sounds like he's talking to Democrats there, the president was. He was at a meeting in Williamsburg, Virginia, with party leaders. Senators from both parties met yesterday to try to bring the total cost of the stimulus package, now at $937 billion, down a bit. Senate Minority Leader, Mitch McConnell, Republican, said the debate would continue.
Those discussions have been going on, and we'll continue them throughout the evening and maybe well into the weekend until we can get some kind of consensus here about what is the most appropriate thing to do to help jumpstart our ailing economy.
No consensus, no vote yet. Proponents of the stimulus had been hoping for a vote by today, but McConnell is right. It's looking more like the weekend.
Officials in Kyrgyzstan say a decision to close a U.S. base that's used to get supplies to troops in Afghanistan is final. But now Russia says it will allow U.S. military supplies to cross its territory. Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg is recovering from surgery yesterday to remove a small tumor from her pancreas. Pancreatic cancer is one of the deadliest forms of the disease, but her doctors caught it early. She'll be in the hospital 7 to 10 days while she's recovering.
Olympic gold medalist Michael Phelps has been suspended from competition for 3 months by USA Swimming. That's after a British paper published pictures of Phelps smoking marijuana. What was he thinking?
Obviously not much. And, like I said, a bad judgment. And, you know, I can learn from it and try to make my life better than it has been in the past.
An excerpt from the Phelps apology. Phelps has also lost Kellogg's lucrative endorsement due to his behavior.
January's unemployment figures will be released this morning. Analysts expect it'll show the unemployment rate has risen to about 7.5%. That would be the highest in 17 years. The Dow closed up more than 1% yesterday to 8,063. The S&P was up more than a percent and a half to 845.
Are you watching people wasting energy and getting mad about it? Tell us your stories at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org, and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. On the Senate floor late last night, Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid of Nevada sounded optimistic about passing a bipartisan economic stimulus package.
A number of Republican senators working with Democratic senators trying to come up with an alternative proposal. Now, I hope something works out on this. I know that everyone's trying in good faith to move this ball down the court.
To get that agreement, senators may be working through the weekend. Takeaway correspondent Andrea Bernstein and Todd Zwillick, reporter for Capital News Connection, are with us now with an update and a look at the Obama presidency after its second full week. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
Hi, good morning.
Todd, now this is a proposal, the stimulus proposal, that passed the House at $819 billion. Now it's being reported it's ballooned to $920 billion. What's going on?
Well, you have a couple of add-ons in the Senate that the Senate has done in the amendment process, and even in the underlying Senate bill that the House didn't do. We've talked in the past about this thing called the AMT, the alternative minimum tax. Every single year, it's sort of a ritual. Congress comes and patches that tax. It was intended for rich people many years ago, 30 years ago. It's since sort of bled into the middle class, so they patch it every year so that middle class people don't have to pay it. That's in the Senate bill. That costs about $70 billion. They passed the other day a tax break for home buyers that was worth, I think, about $19 billion. There are some other things in there. So the price has gone up. And so what you see now, that bipartisan effort that Harry Reid was talking about, is an effort to get the cost of this bill down to a maximum of $800 billion. And I know he was sounding optimistic that this bipartisan group might get a package today that could be voted on. He hasn't said that he supports that effort. He says he's hopeful that they'll be able to come up with something. But he was asked seven different ways yesterday if it's something that the leadership supports. And the answer is not really. I mean, we don't have a package yet. But the leadership said yesterday that they're willing to try to pass this bill with only two or three Republican votes if that's what it takes. And they think they can do it. Now, that is not the bipartisan, broad bipartisan coalition that the president, going into this 2 weeks ago, said he wanted. He said he'd like 80 votes in the Senate, broad Republican support along with Democrats. Chuck Schumer from New York said yesterday that the dream of 80 votes is, quote, a distant memory. It's not going to happen.
A distant memory. What are the sticking points and what's on the table to get it below $800 billion?
Well, there are several sticking points. The big one is the size of the bill. You said right now it's ballooned to around $900 billion, maybe slightly less or slightly more, and that's correct. Most Republicans think that's way too big, and they also think that the mix isn't right. They want more tax cuts. They want less spending. They want the spending that's in there to be more targeted to job creation and things that are truly stimulative, or at least what their experts say is truly stimulative, and you're going to have a fight with the House over this as well. So far, most Republicans have done a pretty good job of keeping their party discipline, and they've been very critical of the Democratic bill. Now, this bipartisan effort.
Can I just stop you there for 1 second?
Sure.
Though? I mean, you know, we're talking about this number. Get it below this. Get it above this. I mean, I've been listening really hard to this debate. It seems like they're just pulling these numbers out of a hat. There's no real economic rationale that it be any particular number, is there?
Probably not. And, you know, John, when you were saying that, it made me think yesterday of what Chairman Max Baucus of the Finance Committee said on the floor. I happened to be sitting there listening to the floor debate, as I unfortunately do quite a bit. And he said, look, none of us on the floor knows exactly, I'm paraphrasing, none of us knows exactly what we're doing. We've never dealt with this before. We're doing the best we can with the information we got. We don't know if 800 is going to work. We don't know if 900, a trillion, or 1.3 is going to work. We're sort of flying by the seat of our pants. We're doing the best we can.
That's reassuring.
Andrew, yeah. What do you make of the bipartisan effort that President Obama has been making and what Todd is describing, that it may not turn out any Republicans vote for his bill?
Well, this is the fascinating thing about all of this, because this bill was constructed with the idea that it was going to get a lot of Republican support. The biggest portion of this bill is tax cuts. And with the AMT patch, it's even bigger. As a matter of fact, that's the main reason the bill has gotten so much bigger in the Senate, is because there are more tax cuts. So when the Obama administration crafted this, they were hoping that a lot of Republicans would just jump on board, or at least enough Republicans to make it seem like a bipartisan effort. Their whole administration has been constructed to try to make things happen with Congress. They have Rahm Emanuel, chief of staff. I mean, you know, in part, Tom Daschle was selected because he was the one who could get healthcare through Congress. So, you know, it's interesting because about a year ago, out on the campaign trail, Hillary Clinton made this speech, which got a lot of criticism and, you know, raised a lot of hackles among Obama supporters when she said, oh, he's going to win and he's going to wave a magic wand and everything is going to work. And as a matter of fact, I think we have that clip and we could listen to it, because in some ways what is happening is that he waved his magic wand and it didn't work out the way he hoped it would.
Now, I could stand up here and say, let's just get everybody together. Let's get unified. The sky will open. The light will come down. Celestial choirs will be singing. And everyone will know we should do the right thing, and the world will be perfect.
So that clearly is not what happened.
And that was before the energy, the economic crisis went, you know, completely south, right?
It's a comment that she was making, and of course everyone's friends now, but it's a comment she was making about sort of being able to come in Washington and sweep through and bring change quickly. Now, on Obama's side, I mean, think about this. 3 weeks ago, he wasn't the president. And, you know, this is the biggest appropriations bill and the quickest moving that anybody can remember. So the fact that he hasn't got it done, I mean, it looks like he's struggling. But on the other hand, you know, here's a man of incredible ambition that set the stakes incredibly high and wasn't able to pull it off yet.
I guess to both of you, the question that I have is, forget this bipartisanship. Just forget it. It's a crisis. We've been talking crisis for the last 2 months. Now it's time to deal with it. Just get the votes. Get it done. Forget Lindsey Graham.
Here's the interesting thing. The Republicans haven't forgotten bipartisanship. My email fills up every day with, you know, sort of nasty little comments from the RNC about the stimulus package. They have maintained a very, you know, tight partisan ranks, which is fascinating when you think 2 million people came to Washington to see Obama's inauguration. The Obama people have been conciliatory, although, you know, in the last week, and in particularly yesterday evening, the president was in Williamsburg at the House Democratic Caucus, and he started sounding like the campaign Obama and saying, you know, what do you think stimulus is? It's spending. And then he even threw in that line, are you fired up? And people yelled, ready to go. So they seem to have decided that the bipartisan program that they've been trying isn't working so well, and they're going back to what they said they were going to do, which is, you know, sort of gathering the American people behind them and creating this wind of change in Washington.
Real quick, Adora, if I can, because from what Andrea says, if they're sort of saying, and what John said, you know, forget bipartisanship, we're ready to get this thing passed. The Democratic leadership said as much yesterday. Like I said, Chuck Schumer said 80 is a distant memory. We're going to get this bill passed. And keep in mind, Democrats have 58 votes. They only need to peel two or three Republicans, and they think they know which ones they want to peel. So those Republicans are kind of holdouts. I'm not prepared to vote for the bill as it stands now, they say. But if this bipartisan effort going on in the back rooms overnight fails today, a couple of little sweeteners to bring two or three Republican moderates over to the yes side, and this bill passes, and the Republican leadership will not have participated in it.
Well, let's talk about news today we're expecting, and that is the unemployment numbers. And Todd, do you think perhaps that's going to put some more pressure on Republicans to get involved or to at least be perceived as part of the solution as opposed to just reminding us about all the problems?
Well, the economic news and the employment news and the housing news has been bad ever since this started. So I'm not sure that one more day of bad news. I think most people just say, of course, the numbers are terrible. Now, rhetorically, yes, I guarantee you, Adora, that this morning after the job numbers come out, Harry Reid will get on the floor and say, look at the job numbers. We need to get this done. Republicans don't stand in the way. They'll try that. Whether or not the Republicans will feel that bite, they haven't so far. They've been four things. They want to do more on housing. They want to do more on tax cuts. So they don't feel like they're being simply obstructionist. They feel like they're offering alternative ideas that are getting voted down. For the most part, a couple of Republican amendments have gotten on this bill. The housing tax credit was a Republican amendment, so it's on there. But the news has been bad since this started. I'm not sure that a little bit more bad news is going to make too much difference today.
Yes or no? You think they're going to be working this weekend?
If Harry Reid, look for one thing called cloture today. If Harry Reid files cloture, that means they're going to vote on Sunday and this bill will not be done. Alternatively, they get it done this afternoon.
Todd Zwillick, thank you. Todd Zwillick is a reporter for Capital News Connection, and Andrea Bernstein is our takeaway political correspondent.
Thank you.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253. Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to helping safeguard businesses and employees through comprehensive insurance products and services. More information at libertymutualgroup.com. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Gentlemen, start your engines. We decided to wind up our trip to the West Coast at an influential technology conference in Long Beach, California. The Power Trip Energy Series ends at the TED Conference here in Long Beach. TED stands for Technology, Entertainment, and Design. And it began a quarter century ago as a kind of get-away-from-it-all retreat for the tragically hip and brilliant and often very rich. But TED has become literally a marketplace for ideas focused on urgent global problems. So I spoke with venture capitalist and TED presenter Vinod Khosla, the founder of Khosla Ventures. Since he's a leading financier in the clean energy sector, he knows firsthand the magical, sometimes random way that new technologies are born.
Two ways. One, somebody has a completely wild idea out of the blue. And other times, people have just been working on a problem and gotten in a rut, and somebody comes up a new way to solve an old problem.
As a venture capitalist, do you have a preference, the wild idea or the person in a rut?
You know, both are interesting as a venture capitalist. As a person, to me, the wild idea is always more fun, it's more crazy, it's more wild, it's more exciting. Do you want to talk about a few examples?
Of people out in left field who could be worth billions in the future? No, I'm not interested in that at all. Please.
A Stanford professor came to me, and he had been working on bone cements. If you have orthopedic surgery, you have to have cement that sets relatively quickly. Normally, when you build a building, cement takes 30 days to get to 15,000 psi of strength. He came to me and he said he can take carbon dioxide and turn it into cement, into a building material. So we take this exhaust and turn it into cement, calcium carbonate. Now, we know calcium carbonate is a building material. Limestone is calcium carbonate. It made so much sense to me. And even though we didn't know how much it would cost or how it would work, it took like less than 45 minutes, and I said, we'll fund this. Let's get going today. Let's not waste an extra day. Now, that's a crazy idea. Let me give you another really crazy idea. A couple of people called me, an old Exxon engineer from Amsterdam. He was doing some crazy stuff. He said, all this cellulosic ethanol stuff you're working on, we know, is not such a good idea.
Cellulosic ethanol, that's ethanol from, say, sugar cane, not from corn.
I'm sorry. Cellulosic ethanol is ethanol from biomass, things like stalks and non-food crops, so not sugar cane, not corn. And we've been working on that, and that looks pretty promising. But this guy said, you're doing the wrong thing. You should use the same wood waste and convert it into crude oil, not ethanol. I said, tell me more. And he says, well, all crude oil comes from wood waste, from biomass. It just takes a few million years. I think I can reduce a few million years to a few minutes. I said, oh, wow, tell me more. And he described, brought this little vial out in which he'd put some dark-looking liquid. He said, I produce this in minutes, and it's just like crude oil. And he went on to explain some of his ideas. As crazy as they were, it made so much sense. It's very simple chemistry. You know, we say oil is hydrocarbons, which is hydrogen and carbon. Well, biomass is hydrogen, carbon, and oxygen. He says, I just take the oxygen out and I'm left with hydrocarbons. It's elegantly simple conceptually, a little hard technically. And it didn't take us long to fund him, and he's off working. In fact, using old refinery equipment to turn wood chips into crude oil that can go into an existing refinery, that can go into existing cars and jet engines and diesel trucks. Those are wild ideas.
And yet, working together, those two wild ideas complement each other, because maybe it's not the best idea to make lots more crude oil and burn it with the carbon problem that we have, but coupled with the calcium carbonate building material idea, where you could take the waste from the new oil and make building materials, suddenly you've got a symbiotic loop going here that could actually have an impact.
Absolutely. These technologies can work together. I like to simplify the climate problem. I say there's only four problems: coal, oil, cement, and steel. If we solve those four, we're done. We don't have to worry about waiting for other things. Most of the things we talk about are sort of silly. You know, Shell Coal likes to say use one sheet of toilet paper instead of two. Well, most people in the world don't even use toilet paper. It's not going to make a difference. What's going to make a difference is go after the bulk of the carbon emissions. More than 75% of them come from these four things. If we can solve those four, we are done. If we don't solve those four, we can do everything else and we won't be done.
Is it going to happen quick enough?
Can it happen quick enough? Yes and no. Yes, in the technology part. In the next 3 years or 5 years, will we have the technologies to solve our carbon emissions problem from coal power plants, or be able to replace oil, fossil oil, with a renewable oil? Yes. And we will have the technologies to do it, not only do it, but do it economically enough where people could adopt it. Then we have a harder problem, the political will. Will we institute a carbon price? Will we force people to change? There's lots of embedded interests. What role will they play in the politics? That's a harder question to answer. I can't tell you we will. I'm hopeful we will.
Is there science to answering that political question?
I don't think so. It's political science, which is not science, of course.
Well, you know, thank you very, very much. It's been great talking to you.
It's been Vinod Khosla, founder of Khosla Ventures, a venture capital firm that's playing a leading role in financing some wild ideas that may help transform the energy sector. You know, at the TED conference, Adora, there's all kinds of this can-do attitude. Here's Ray Anderson, the founder of Interface Incorporated, the world's largest manufacturer of modular carpet. One time, somebody told him he couldn't do something. This was his response.
DuPont told us a long time ago, when they were the inventors of nylon, and they told us, it's not possible. You won't be able to recycle nylon economically. Well, we are, in fact, doing it today.
There's a lot of that same kind of optimism kicking around here, and you know, it makes you feel good, but there's still, the problems are pretty daunting.
But it's good to know that there's some really big brains working on it.
And the biggest brains maybe need to be in the political sector. These guys talk very much about how much the political will is really going to be the key. And that's why we're asking all of you, what is it that really annoys you about energy waste? And how could you mobilize your own energy to change things? And your response?
People go out and build 10, 12,000 square foot homes, and two people live in it. If they want to build 12,000 square feet, fine, but two people only need 800 square feet living space.
No more McMansions. Tell us your environmental annoyance and what you would do to change it. 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of auto insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. Mark Garrison is here now with the latest headlines this morning, sitting in for Femi Okeh.
Thank you, Adora. Coming up on 33 minutes after the hour, Senate moderates in both parties want to cut some $90 billion from the economic stimulus package that's ballooned to almost $940 billion. They're meeting again today. On the chopping block is some education and health spending. Senate Democratic leader Harry Reid is hopeful they can work something out.
I'm optimistic that we can get something done, and I hope that that, in fact, is the case. Everyone's going to have to give a little.
The president says he wants a bill on his desk in the next 10 days. The UN chief is in Iraq today, meeting with Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki. He said local elections there were an important step toward full democracy, but told Iraqis they still have work to do. The elections went forward without major violence earlier in the week. The secretary general was in Afghanistan. And Zimbabwe's president, Robert Mugabe, is set to amend the country's constitution. This clears the way for opposition leader Morgan Tsvangirai to become the country's prime minister. The signing of the bill moves forward a power-sharing agreement stalled for months. John.
Thank you, Mark. Well, some sobering news just crossing the wires at this moment. The Department of Labor issued the latest jobs report for the month of January. Consider these numbers. In the last 3 months, more than a half million people have lost their jobs. The latest report for January, payrolls dropped by 598,000. That's the most since 1974. The jobless rate has risen to 7.6%. It's not a surprise. Perhaps that's the most disturbing thing about it. Jim Ellis, Assistant Managing Editor at Businessweek, joins us in our studios in New York City. Jim, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
You know, these are huge steps, into an unemployment situation that we really haven't seen since the mid-70s when I graduated from high school. There's nothing really surprising about this number, but these are huge incremental changes month to month. What do you make of it?
I think that this was a bit of a surprise for the markets. I mean, people had been expecting a big number, probably in the 550, 560 range, and to see almost 600,000 jobs, leaving is a big hit, especially after yesterday's report of initial unemployment claims, which was about 626,000 people who just lost their jobs last week. And if you looked at also the four-week average, that's gone up. And if you look at the number of people who are what they call continuing unemployment claims, in other words, they've been on unemployment and they've been on there more than a week, it's already up to like more than 4.5 million people. I mean, this is a large unemployment problem, which we typically see in a recession, but people didn't really expect it to be this great, this fast. What's happening now is that lots of employers are dumping workers very, very quickly. And that's a little different than the typical recession.
Well, it feels like a kind of capitulation. You know, we were looking at capitulation in the market back in October. This is a sort of a capitulation in the labor market. There's a couple of multiplier effects that I wonder if you'd explore. Number one, with essentially a 30% increase in the number of unemployed month to month, if we're, looking over the last 3 months, I mean, if we're extending unemployment benefits to all of these people as it's rising this fast, that's an enormous drain on the Treasury as it's trying to deal with the stimulus package. That's multiplier number one. What do you make of that?
Well, I mean, it's going to mean that we're going to have a lot more what I consider to be regular social spending as opposed to stimulus spending that we're going to have to do. That makes the administration's job a little bit harder simply because these numbers are out there. However, unemployment benefits being what they aren't as big a drain. I think the bigger hit here is the psychology hit that it does to the economy from a spending standpoint. When people are fearful of their jobs or they don't have jobs, they don't spend. And right now, spending is the big problem for this economy.
And that's the other multiplier factor that I want to explore. Let's look at the way these jobs are being lost. This isn't cost cutting or cost saving. These are wholesale shutdowns of operations in sectors all over the economy. And we're also seeing a revision of statistics over the last quarter that indicate that it was even worse in, a month ago, 2 months ago than we thought. So you see multipliers going back and forward, and they're still saying that there are many more unemployment, many more layoffs to come.
There are many more layoffs to come simply because what employers are doing now is saying there's not enough demand out there for us to even merit keeping people working. We also saw another hint of that in the jobs claims numbers yesterday, where it appears that a lot of people, productivity also came out. We saw productivity go up. People said, oh, that's great. We want to be a productive workforce. But the reason productivity went up was that they were throwing out so many workers faster than demand was actually dropping, that it made everybody who was left working harder. I mean, this is hurting not just people who work, but also people who don't work. Everybody gets slammed by this. It's an amazing thing that I have to admit the markets are not going to respond very well to this number today, simply because they expected it to be a little bit better.
And of course, this kind of news, Jim, is not going to encourage anybody to start spending. And if that's the solution, to start spending, I mean, how do you make that happen?
Well, that's the $64,000 question, or in this case, the $2 trillion question, which is how do you juice spending? The only thing you can do is probably to put money that can't be saved into the pockets of people. The problem is that all of a sudden, after years of not having to save, simply because you could use your house as a bank or you could use the markets as a bank, people have suddenly discovered that I've got to have a nest egg. I've got to have a slush fund. And that is really keeping people down. We saw the savings rate over the last couple of quarters actually soar to almost 3% on an annualized basis. Now, you sort of remember that this U.S. savings rate had dropped to zero. People had no need to save anymore, they thought. And now all of a sudden they're saving. This is what in economics you call the paradox of thrift, that it's a great thing to have people save because it means there's capital out there to invest. The problem is that you also need them to spend. You don't want them to save too much. You want them to spend to juice the economy, which increases demand and therefore has more demand for more workers and increases unemployment.
But everyone's scared.
Everybody's scared. I mean, people forget that economics is not a hard science. Economics is not like chemistry or something like that where you do something and it happens. Economics is like psychology. And it becomes very difficult to manage simply because you know the general things that you have to do, but they often don't have that I do this, I get this result that you get in a hard science.
Yeah, it seems like the control panel is not really responding to the, captain of the ship here. Let's look at a couple of levers. Yesterday here at the TED conference out in Long Beach, California, an economist was suggesting that it's conceivable that the dollar will, like, fade away as a reserve currency. And he was describing that that's sort of the safety net that's keeping value in the U.S. economy as these job losses continue. The Fed auctioned off $67 billion of Treasury notes this week. It was a huge, huge number. There's a suggestion out there that as we get into this stimulus package with these huge numbers of U.S. layoffs, that the world is not going to finance these various stimulus programs, and then we're going to be in a whole other crisis 6 months from now. What do you make of that, Jim?
Well, that is the long-term fear, which is that most of the U.S. debt, U.S. sovereign debt, is actually bought by a couple of central banks, China and Japan. They have socked away their extra money here in the U.S. If they lose faith in us, that goes away, and we have a hard time sort of financing our debt.
The alternative is assistant managing editor at Business Week. We'll talk about those alternatives when we come back. Thanks, Jim.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Good morning. This is The Takeaway. I'm Adora Udoji.
And I'm John Huckenberry, continuing our discussion with Jim Ellis, Assistant Managing Editor at Business Week, reporting on 598,000 people reported unemployed, added to the unemployment rate in January. The jobless rate is now at 7.6%. Jim, we were talking a moment ago about who is financing the various stimulus packages that are on the table, the tremendous pressure for the U.S. to get cash to support these stimulus operations, and it looks like that pool is diminishing at a rapid rate. Continue what you were saying.
Well, I mean, we depend on foreign central banks to buy our U.S. debt. The issue is that a lot of them are saying, I've gotten burned in that so far. I also question whether the U.S. is going to be the economy it was going forward. That puts a lot of pressure on us. From a near term, it's a good thing that they don't have an alternative. Right now, the global recession is indeed a global thing. So therefore, they don't have a safe haven to run to other than the U.S. Longer term, this is a real problem. I mean, especially since the Chinese have decided that they want to diversify where they hold their money.
not only diversify, they also have their own unemployment problem to deal with. They need to funnel cash to keep workers happy inside China. That's what we learned this week. They've got 26 million unemployed that they have to deal with, and that's going to grow also.
I mean, they're a developing economy. They need to keep a really high rate not only of growth but also of employment. And just to keep stability there. I mean, we think we would die to have 3 or 4% growth here, and growth less than 7% of their economy sort of risks social unrest. It's a very weird dynamic over there.
I mean, that 7% growth in China is financing all of what's going on in the economy. I heard an option yesterday. You said that nations don't have an option for investing in treasuries because they're the safe haven. But I heard a really interesting option. Okay, we'll borrow money or we'll lend you money, United States, but we want you to pay it back in our currency, not in dollars. If the Chinese were to say, okay, we'll loan you yuans, not dollars, and you have to pay them back in yuans, that would have enormous implications for inflation here in the United States. Is that a possible scenario?
I don't think it's a possible scenario because right now I don't think anybody has the power to actually force that on the U.S. But in a way, that is the way that the U.S. Has pretty well imposed its financial will on other countries in the past. You know, borrow in dollars, pay us back in dollars.
Yeah, it's an interesting point. Well, let's get back to the major point. It's unemployment that we're talking about here. 598,000 are on the street, joining the millions who are already there. What do you expect in the next couple of months, Jim?
Unfortunately, given the way that the inventory situation is in the economy right now, and remember, inventories are often the thing that presses an employer to cut his workforce, and the fact that we can't see demand coming back for at least another couple of quarters, the unemployment rate has to continue upward, probably in the range of 9% at the peak, which will probably be late this year, and we're probably going to have a lot more job losses. This is just the way it works when you have an economy that's almost crippled and a credit system that's come to a halt.
And when we talk probably later on in that third quarter of this year, we're probably going to be looking at jobs that are never going to return and sorting out what of this is a total permanent shutdown and what of this are jobs that are shifting into fundamentally new sectors. Not much to look forward to, but there's going to be a lot of economics that we'll be looking at over the next few months. Jim Ellis, Assistant Managing Editor at Business Week, thanks so much for helping us to sort it out.
Thank you.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Friday, February 6th, and Mark Garrison is in for Femi Okeh, and he's got some headlines for us.
Thank you, Adora. We're coming up on 12 minutes before the hour. President Barack Obama is announcing his team of outside economic experts today. Their goal, among other things, turning those jobless numbers around that we've been talking about. The Economic Recovery Advisory Board will be headed by former Fed Chair Paul Volcker. The announcement comes as Obama presses lawmakers to pass his economic recovery stimulus package. Senate moderates are circulating a list of nearly $90 billion worth of cuts in the president's package. It's currently nearly $940 billion for the total tab. The last Guantanamo Bay trial is on hold. Charges against an al-Qaeda suspect in the 2000 USS Cole bombing have been dropped. 17 American sailors died in the Yemen attack. This was the last active war crimes case at Gitmo. President Obama ordered freezes on all trials for review. The Pentagon says new charges against the suspected bomber can be brought later. He will stay in prison for now. This afternoon, the president will meet with families of the Cole bombing victims and 9/11 attacks. Some families have protested the order to halt Gitmo trials, saying they've waited long enough for justice. In Pakistan, nuclear scientist Abdul Qadir Khan has been released by the High Court in Islamabad. That's according to his lawyer. A.Q. Khan was put under house arrest in 2004 when he acknowledged his involvement in the illicit nuclear technology trade. He confessed at the time to selling secrets to Iran, North Korea, and Libya. He later retracted the confession, saying it had been made under pressure. Toyota says it expects a full year operating loss, three times bigger than predicted. predicted. It's the first loss by the Japanese manufacturer in its 70-year history. Toyota made a loss of $4 billion in the last 3 months of 2008 and said it expects a full-year loss of nearly $5 billion. Adora.
Thanks very much, Mark. It's Friday, which means most of us can take a breather and look forward to a little entertainment this weekend. And for some ideas on what you might want to do, Allison Williams, Associate Features Editor at Time Out New York, is back with us with some things for us to watch, to hear, and to see, and some of it is free. Good morning and welcome, Allison. First thing, what can I listen to?
Well, Springsteen is a classic.
Absolutely.
So he has a new album out, and he just played at the Super Bowl, and it's just another hit.
Okay, let's take a listen. That's sounding rather upbeat.
Yeah, that's the nice thing. He's optimistic. This is not the Springsteen who's talking about factories closing and depression. He's got the radio-friendly music out. Think Born to Run and all the stuff you like singing along to. It's kind of strange. He's got songs, you've got titles that have words like lucky and dream and surprise. It's a nice change from him. If you saw the Super Bowl halftime show, you're probably back in the mood for some of The Boss. And it's Working on a Dream. It's a great album.
And I think
it's
a lot
number
of
one album.
Yes,
it's
indeed.
Number one, isn't it? Yeah, yeah. Incredible.
And people need a little uplifting things these days. And how about some comedy? I hear you've got some things that might give us a few laughs over the weekend.
Indeed. A new comedy album called from a group called The Lonely Island called Incredibad.
Lazy Sunday, wake up in the late afternoon. Call Parnell just to see how he's doing. Hello, what up, Parn?
Yo, Sandberg, what's cracking?
So what exactly is that? It sounds a little bit like the Beastie Boys, but maybe I'm dating myself.
It is. It's a guy named Andy Samberg. He's on Saturday Night Live, and indeed that sketch appeared on Saturday Night Live originally. It's musical comedy. It's fun to listen to, and it's often ripping off some popular genres like the Beastie Boys. They've got guests like Jack Black and Norah Jones and Justin Timberlake, and it's a little juvenile. You know, your inner 13-year-old will probably be really happy at some of the naughty words, but it's fun, it's funny, and it's playful.
Your inner 13-year-olds. What about those who are actually 13?
You know, there's a movie coming out called Coraline. It's an animated movie. Some of it's in 3D, and it's really fantastic.
She's got this whole world where everything's better, but it's all a trap.
You may come out when you've learned to be a loving daughter.
Isn't it kind of dark? I mean, is this really for children or young adults?
It's probably a little too scary for the little ones. I know when I saw it, I was just absolutely transfixed. I kind of wish I'd been 8 or 10 years old when I saw it.
Oh, my kids are crazy for this movie. Yes. They can't wait.
It's incredibly beautiful. Think like The Nightmare Before Christmas. It's got stop motion animation, beautiful music. That was Dakota Fanning's voice, and she's a professional. She's very good at what she does. And it is, if you go see it in 3D, which I highly recommend, it's beautiful.
And if you don't want to go to the movies, though, of course, there's the weekly DVD release. What's out there this weekend?
W, the movie from Oliver Stone, which just came out on DVD.
All right, let's hear just a bit of it.
What do you do, Lord?
Oh, I read, I smoke.
Uh-huh.
I admire.
You admire what?
People who write, who read. I'm a librarian.
Uh-oh.
Uh-oh.
No, actually, I'm reading something right now. Yeah, very engaging book.
Oh, what is it?
Barry Goldwater's Conscience of a Conservative.
Uh-oh. Jam.
No, don't tell me.
Well, I worked on Gene McCarthy's campaign. Voted for LBJ.
Oh, no. No. Well, looks like we're hitting it off like grease hits a skillet, huh?
So that's a scene that is supposed to represent when George Bush met mm-hmm. Laura Welch, who would become his wife.
Yep. That was Josh Brolin playing Bush and Elizabeth Banks as Laura. And Oliver Stone has done quite a few presidential movies. He did Nixon and JFK. This is kind of a funnier movie. And not to say it's laughing at Bush. Often it's sort of laughing at the more comic side of him, his nicknaming. And it was maybe a little bit of a stressful movie to watch during the presidency, whether you sort of supported or were against Bush, just because, you know, things were a little complicated at that time. Now on the other side of his presidency, it's kind of a fun thing to watch and relax and laugh at the funnier aspects of his presidency and really think about how you feel about his presidency, how you feel about history. It's kind
of
fun.
It actually got pretty good reviews when it came out, didn't it?
Yeah, I think a lot of people were sort of puzzled by it. It was kind of a strange thing to do, watching people play Cheney and Rove and Condoleezza Rice. They don't always hit, but I think it's a lot more entertaining than I think anyone ever expected.
It's funny how the context has changed almost instantaneously. It's sort of a remembering the good old awful days movie. It's a nostalgia piece.
Indeed.
And we always like free things. Everyone likes free things. And you got something free for us to do this weekend. What is it?
Yes, on PBS, it's a documentary about the assassination of Abraham Lincoln. Lots of fun.
At the very moment Lincoln's funeral train departed Washington, his murderer lay shivering in the reeds beside the Potomac River. The largest manhunt in American history was closing in, and John Wilkes Booth managed to scribble a few words in his diary.
Our cause being almost lost, something decisive and great must be done.
I wonder if our president, President Obama, is going to be watching, since he's such a big fan of President Lincoln.
Yeah, Lincoln has sort of been a very popular topic right now, reportedly very popular with President Obama. So it's kind of neat to look back, sort of explore what happened around his death and how the myth of Abraham Lincoln came to be. And this is a PBS American Experience documentary. It's really high quality. You know those cheesy reenactments that sort of happen in a lot of history stuff? There's just enough to get you in the sort of historical documentary mood, but not so much that you're starting to feel really embarrassed at all the people running around in their Civil War uniforms type of thing.
Allison Williams, it's always a great pleasure. You've given us something to listen for, something to go to the movie theater for, and something to watch at home if we just want to hang out. Allison Williams is the Associate Features Editor of Time Out New York. John?
And those Civil War reenactors love dressing up in those costumes, so I'm sure they're not
I was visualizing them, which is why I was chuckling.
Yeah, and it's, you know, a historical piece. Illinois before Blagojevich, you know, Abraham Lincoln, remember him?
Right.
So we've been talking about energy consciousness all week. When you see energy being wasted right in front of you, what drives you crazy? How much does it annoy you?
What bugs me is when I see people walking around with their designer green shopping bags filled with fluorescent light bulbs, and meanwhile, they have cheeseburgers stuck between their teeth. The energy it takes to raise a pound of beef is staggering.
I hate when people use the doors to the side of revolving door on a cold day in a business lobby.
What if you're in a wheelchair, though? Hey, come on. What annoys you about people wasting energy at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org? It's what we've been talking about as I've been out here on the West Coast for our Power Trip series that closes today, covering the future technology of energy. We're also reporting on the federal stimulus plan here at The Takeaway, but there's only so much we can do as reporters. We are enlisting you to be our reporters on the ground to help us dig up more on individual projects happening around the country. You can tell us where stimulus money is going in your area, what it's missing. Take part in our crowdsourcing project called Shovel Watching. You can go to thetakeaway.org to find out more. So this Friday is a pretty special Friday for you, Adora. Tell us the good news.
It's a very special day. My husband Ron and I have adopted a six-month-old little girl from Ethiopia, and so we're heading to pick her up next week. I'm all ears on advice, parenting advice, because I hear it's kind of a tough job, John.
I wouldn't know. I just have four kids. What do we have a name?
We do. Her name is Siobhan, a good old Gaelic name.
Oh, that's lovely.
So I'm going to be on maternity leave for 2 months.
Well, good luck. You're going to have a great, great adventure, and we want to hear all about it when you come back. Any fears at this point?
We're a little anxious, you know. Our
I'm
lives
sure.
are going to change in lots of big ways, and we're very excited, though, very excited. She's a gorgeous, lively little girl.
Well, congratulations. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Adora Udoji, and this is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
Concerning global energy and the environment, it's all coming back to me now.
I listened to a lot of media, and population concerns went out in the 60s and never came back. I guess it's China's problem. I think the media has a responsibility to explore and discuss overpopulation as much as it covers greenhouse gases and the ice melt.
Just one of your concerns as Takeaway listeners weigh in on global priorities. A week-long power trip on the future of energy ends with a chorus of voices. yours. We asked, you answered. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Friday, February 6th. John is joining us from Los Angeles today on the last day of our series Power Trip, where we've been looking at the future of energy. Good morning, John.
Good morning, everyone. And we've been certainly grateful for all the voices out there listening to us who have joined the conversation.
And good morning to everyone, too. I'm going to add that in there. Today, we're going to check in with Republican Senator Charles Grassley on the Obama stimulus package. The senators were up late working last night. And also, we take a look at energy demands and population growth, as John talked about at the top of the show. Those stories are coming up, but first, today's headlines.
January unemployment figures came out this morning, and it's even a bit more grim than analysts had expected. Nearly 600,000 people filed for unemployment last month, raising the current national unemployment rate to 7.6%, and that's a 17-year high. The economy is reacting, analysts are reacting, and markets are reacting. The Dow futures are pointing lower after being marginally higher most of the morning.
Another day, another push from Senate Democrats to get the votes they need to pass the president's stimulus plan. Meanwhile, a president who was voted in on change waits.
Don't come to the table with the same tired arguments and worn ideas that helped to create this crisis.
A group of senators from both parties met behind closed doors yesterday to try to cut more than $1 billion from the current $937 billion price tag. Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid says a compromise will be reached.
I'm optimistic that we can get something done, and I hope that that, in fact, is the case. Everyone's going to have to give a little.
But Republican Senator Lindsey Graham says what's at stake is bigger than just both parties giving a little here and there.
I am telling you right now that if this is the solution to George Bush's problems, the country is going to get worse. If this is the new way of doing business, if this is the change we all can believe in, America's best days are behind her.
Many had hoped a vote would come today, but it's looking less likely.
Officials in Kyrgyzstan say a decision to close a U.S. base that's used to get supplies to troops in Afghanistan is final. But now Russia says, in some sort of sign of compromise, it will allow U.S. military supplies to cross its territory. Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg will spend a week or so in the hospital, recovering from surgery yesterday to remove a small tumor from her pancreas. Pancreatic cancer is one of the deadliest forms of the disease, but her doctors caught it early. We already gave you the market news. I'm on the West Coast this week for our series Power Trip. We're looking at the future of energy. You're energy conscious, and how do you feel when you see people wasting energy? You can tell us your environment. You can tell us your story at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. And by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
The number of Republican senators working with Democratic senators trying to come up with an alternative proposal. Now, I hope something works out on this. I know that everyone's trying in good faith to move this ball down the court.
That Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid sounding optimistic, perhaps, last night as the Senate was trying to work its way through the Obama stimulus plan. It was a very late night, and senators may keep working through the weekend. This morning, we are joined again by Republican Senator Charles Grassley of Iowa. We kicked off this week's stimulus conversation with the senator on Monday, and he was poised to vote no on the bill then. Have 5 days of debate made a difference? Good morning, and welcome back, Senator.
Yes, glad to be with you, Adora.
So are you as optimistic as Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid is?
Well, he said in the statement you just publicized for him that if everybody would give a little, we haven't got even a little yet on our side. We've offered all these amendments, and none of them have been adopted. So the president, you know, I think I quoted him the last time we talked as saying Republicans have a lot of good ideas. We want a bipartisan plan. We heard Dr. Summers, his economic advisor, say that it ought to be temporary, targeted, and timely. And half of this bill is not temporary, and that's the main problem. It is not the size of the bill. We heard somebody say, well, let's get it down $100 billion. $100 billion isn't the issue. The issue is that half of it is not temporary in the sense that you get it spent right now and get the economy jump-started, and then the programs end, because half of this bill is going to go on for the next two or three decades the way it's written up. So it's become a subterfuge for people that just want to spend, as opposed to jump-start the economy.
You mentioned that there's some amendments the Republicans have put forth. Which ones are you talking about, and have any of them been endorsed by the president?
I don't know whether the president asked us to run them by him. As far as I know, he just said that the Republicans had a lot of good ideas. Well, let's just look at one yesterday that was offered by Senator McCain. It was one to take care of the problem that we have with the credit crunch. It's because housing is dropping out of the sky, and we want to stabilize the price of houses. So we offered an amendment with 4% interest loans, not only for those in foreclosures, but those that want to refinance, and it was rejected.
Senator, you know, you said a moment ago that half of this bill is permanent.
Yeah.
And, you know, that may or may not be true, but it seems to me, and forgive me for sort of hammering you here, but it seems a little disingenuous. I mean, what's permanent? You're the Congress. If you don't like it, you could repeal it in 2 years. Well, what do you mean permanent?
Well, I'm taking just Dr. Summers, the president's economic advisor. He said in order to be a stimulus package, it ought to be timely, temporary, and targeted. So temporary in their definition is a 2-year period of time. So if you hire, let's say you expand programs where you got to hire a lot of help, are you going to lay off that help afterwards, like when you help a local school district? Because the federal government's not going to be shoveling money into local school districts for the next 30 or 40 years for just regular education. That's a local level, and nobody's here advocating that. But you expand a program like that, get local school districts to crank up, and then the federal government pulls the plug. You don't think that those the local school districts can continue to pay for something the federal government was paying for, and so it's not temporary. So I'm just taking the president at his words and Dr. Summer at his words, and we're trying to define this bill the way with what they asked for. And if it's a 20 or 30 year program, then obviously it's not temporary.
But we can't just hire some teachers and then worry about that if we run out of money in 2 years, and then you can come back?
Well, don't you think that that's the way the federal government got into a lot of trouble, by not having the long view?
But
we haven't had the long view. That's why we got the fiscal problems we have.
But, Senator, at what point, given the level of the economic crisis right now, do you just get some of these programs going and then evaluate them as you move forward and as the economic indicators change and evolve?
Well, let's look at what infrastructure is. Infrastructure is, and we're putting a lot of money into infrastructure in this bill. You build a mile of highway this year, you aren't going to build the same mile of highway next year. That's altogether different than setting up a whole new program where you're going to hire a bunch of help, and then at the end of 2 years, the program's over. You know, this is a stimulus program, or a stimulus bill. This is not a program bill. This is a bill to jumpstart the economy. This is a bill we wouldn't even be talking about if we were not in a recession.
Senator, the president said last night that, you know, the idea of spending and stimulus are not unrelated. For instance, he talked about getting an energy-efficient fleet for the federal government, that some Republicans don't like that idea. But he said very forcefully at essentially a campaign rally, a party rally in Williamsburg, that, hey, we're buying cars. That's what we need to do. It employs workers who build cars, and it has a long-term impact on the efficiency and costs of the federal government. What's wrong with that?
Well, you mentioned something that there's nothing wrong with. I was mentioning programs that there is something wrong with. You buy a car, you pay for it once. You drive it till it wears out. And that could be 1 year, or that could be 15 years. For me, it would be 15 years. So that fits into the area of infrastructure. What we're talking about is programs that wouldn't otherwise... Listen, the answer is that if you're going to have new programs, you ought to go through the thoughtful process of 4 or 5 months that appropriations go through every year to authorize it and to appropriate money for it, as opposed to trying something brand new and trying to shove it down everybody's throat in 1 week. That isn't thoughtful approach. When you have a permanent program, you ought to think about it a long time, as opposed to you got engineering plans on the shelf, but you don't have enough gas tax money coming in to fund it this year because people are driving less or paying less gas tax. So the federal government is going to put some money in to build that highway, to hire the people that are going to do the work. And when that highway is built, you know, it's built for 30 or 40 years.
It sounds like it's going to take a lot for you to back this proposal. What specifically do you think it would take, and are you think it's going to happen? I mean, are you going to work through the weekend?
How much? Well, we get paid by the year, so we don't have to worry about whether it's Saturday or Sunday. And we got a crisis out there with this economic recession we're in. So we will.
Well, Senator,
work,
if it's a crisis,
what it takes is for the Democrats in Congress to do exactly what the president said. He said the Republicans have some good ideas. We ought to work with the Republicans and get a bipartisan proposal. And the second thing is to do what Dr. Summers says: make sure it's targeted, temporary, and timely.
All right, Senator, but you know, I hate to start your day off wrong, but it really feels like you're trying to have it both ways here. On the one hand, if this is an emergency, then we need to do something quick. And on the other hand, if you have a problem with thinking in the short term, what's wrong with having a long view set of programs that are going to be around for a while? I can't reconcile those statements you've made.
Well, you can't reconcile it because you probably don't mind the federal government screwing up and making mistakes like we do when you do things in a hasty way. Infrastructure is not a hasty decision because the decisions to build a building have been going on for maybe 2 or 3 years at the local level. They just don't have the money. So we're going to put the money out there, and the money's going to be wisely spent. But when you...
All right, but Senator, haven't we had ignoring the problem for 8 years? I mean, the argument goes, why don't we try hasty and see if that works? Could we just do that?
Well, what are you talking about? We've ignored the problem for 8 years. We haven't done anything on infrastructure different the 8 years than we have the last 30 years. Most of the infrastructure is done at the local level, not the federal level. We're talking about at the federal level helping local people do what they don't have the money to do now because the gas tax hasn't bringing in as much money as local governments thought, or because industry isn't paying as much money into the federal or into the state treasuries. That isn't anything that took 8 years to happen.
All right, 8 years, 30 years. You're certainly giving us a flavor of the debate there in the Senate, Senator Grassley, that's for sure.
Well, what we want to do what the president wants, and I just told you, timely, targeted, temporary, and that Republicans have good ideas, and the president's urging his party to look at those ideas, and we're finding out that the Democrats in the Congress aren't doing what their own president and my president's telling them to do.
Senator, we thank you for talking with us this morning. We know you had a late night, and we certainly wish you the best. That's Republican Senator Charles Grassley of Iowa talking about the Obama stimulus plan.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to helping safeguard businesses and employees through comprehensive insurance products and services. More information at libertymutualgroup.com. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
This week, The Takeaway launched our series called Power Trip. We've been taking a look at the future of energy, talking all week about new technologies that could help us save energy. But quite a few of you thought that our discussion should also have included the issue of population growth.
Hi, my name is Kate. This is my question. Is the media ever going to explore the idea that man is overpopulating the planet? As the oil will surely run out, so will the planet run out of space. We can't continue to think that land is infinite, yet we do.
So is it worth talking about all these new technologies to save energy if we're not dealing with a drastically growing population? David Biello is here to help us explore that question. He covers the environment and energy at Scientific American Online, and he's here in the studio. Thanks for being with us, David.
Thank you.
So do we need to have that discussion when we're looking at ways to save energy? Do we automatically need to be looking at the population growth?
Well, it's certainly a major issue. As we all know, I think population has been growing pretty strongly over the past century or so, particularly in places like China and India that are rapidly developing. And government statistics show that as population grows, energy use grows. It makes sense, kind of from the Stone Age to today. More people means more fires if you're back in your cave. If you're a modern man, it means more cars.
I actually have some numbers here. The UN projects by 2025, that's 16 years from now, we'll go from 6.6 billion people on the planet to 8 billion people on the planet. How is that going to affect energy needs?
Yeah, and some people actually say more than that. It really kind of depends on people's individual choices. I think it's a tough question to answer simply. The 8 billion people is, frankly, not that many more. We have the oil, we have the coal, we have the natural gas to kind of burn our way out of that problem. The real question is how much energy is each individual person going to use? If you look at the statistics, you know, here in the U.S., We're burning 335 million BTUs. That's the amount of energy. It's a kind of archaic energy measure. That's the amount of energy it takes to raise 1 pound of liquid water 1 degree Fahrenheit at one atmospheric pressure. In China and India, they use basically 1/6 and 1/10 of that. So that's about 50 million BTUs, and in India, 15 million BTUs.
Or another way to expand on that, this is a number I was actually blown away by. China consumes 7.9 million barrels of oil a day. The U.S., with less than one quarter as many people as China, consumes 20.7 million barrels a day.
That's right. Well, it's because we have a lot more cars. They have a lot more people. We have a lot more cars. And the question becomes, are they going to have a lot more cars? And I was in China last May, and all indicators that I could see and people that I've talked to is they are going to have a lot more cars. And then the question becomes, what kind of cars are they going to have?
And so, as you said, it is a very big issue. But let's say you were advising somebody in the Obama administration. How would you set that agenda for them? How would you set that discussion and debate that you think needs to happen?
Well, it's not so much what the Obama administration can kind of tell China to do. It's kind of what China will decide to do on its own.
But even in a macro sense, just in looking at energy issues and population growth issues.
Well, they're already doing quite a bit. In the stimulus package that you were just chatting about, there's a lot of efficiency measures. This is the way in which we can kind of cut back on energy use through improvements to our electricity grid, requiring more fuel economy from our cars. Another kind of interesting factoid is that Chinese cars are actually more fuel efficient than American cars are required to be. Those kinds of efficiency measures are what kind of saved us from the first oil crisis in the late 70s and early 80s. That was the one time in kind of energy history that population growth and energy growth decoupled for a brief window of time.
And you also talk about how you think there's got to be a cultural element of it? Is that just to make energy, saving energy cool? I mean, is that what you're talking about?
I mean, I think that's part of it. What I'm really talking about there is kind of that shift that happened in the 70s from kind of those big Cadillacs, you might remember, to smaller cars that were more fuel efficient. I think Dick Cheney called that personal virtue, and Jimmy Carter might have shown that by wearing a sweater in the White House.
Right. That, as I recall, it didn't go over so well.
No, that didn't go over so well. And personal virtue isn't really going to get us where we want to go. We're not all trying to become, a vegan Prius-driving environmentalists. What is going to save us is kind of using energy more smartly. So this is something as simple as, you know, those power converters kind of on all your electrical gadgets.
Right, sure.
They get all heated up. And that's because they're using a lot of energy. Plug all of those into a power strip and turn that power strip off at night, and you will watch your power bills plummet.
Well, there's a takeaway for us. David Biello, thanks so much. David Biello is an associate editor covering the environment and energy at Scientific American Online. John?
You know, the population growth and the number of people the planet can support is really a debate and a theme out here at the TED conference in Long Beach, California.
I think a lot of people do think that the planet is absolutely capable of sustaining 6, 7, maybe 10 billion people if we're smarter about how we live.
That's Chris Anderson, who's the curator of the TED conference. How many people can the planet support? It's a real issue bearing directly on our energy technological future. Now, headlines from Mark Garrison.
Thank you, John. Coming up on 28 minutes after the hour, President Obama will spend time today with families of the USS Cole and 9/11 attack victims. The meeting follows a move by a top Pentagon judge to drop charges against an al-Qaeda suspect in the Cole attack. President Obama ordered a halt to it and all trials at Guantanamo Bay. Some victims' families were angry with the order. They say they've waited too long already for justice. The confirmation of President Obama's labor secretary pick is snagged on a tax issue. The Senate halted a confirmation vote on Hilda Solis his nomination yesterday. She's the latest nominee facing questions about taxes, but in this case, it's her husband's taxes causing trouble. He recently settled an unpaid tax issue related to his business. Lawmakers say they need more time to review documents supporting Solis. The White House says she should not be held to blame for her husband's tax mistake. Some 200,000 California state employees are staying home without pay today. Governor Schwarzenegger ordered the two-day-a-month furlough to help solve the state's $42 billion budget shortfall. Of offices like the Department of Motor Vehicles will be closed, but fire stations and job centers will stay open. For employees getting furloughed, they amount to actually a 9% pay cut. In a new study in the journal Science has some interesting findings about what colors do for your brain. The color red maybe improves attention to detail. Blue sparks creativity. The researcher, Juliet Zhu, she gives a little color scheme advice based on what she found.
If the task is calling for attention to details, like memorizing important information, go with red. But if the task calls for creativity, coming up with innovative uses for a project or idea, then go with blue color.
It's interesting. They gave people the same test, but on a screen, one that was red, one that was blue, and they found better results in the creativity for the blue, and then for the kind of memorization and proofreading for
the
red.
Are you a red or blue person, Mark?
I'm going to go with purple. How about that?
Thanks, Mark Garrison.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of auto insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. I'm live out here on the West Coast in Los Angeles, where we're finishing up our series on energy future technology called the Power Trip. It's not my personal power trip. It's something we've been exploring all week.
You just like saying that, don't you?
I love saying that. Power Trip. So if you're energy conscious and you're thinking about people wasting energy, maybe in your eyesight, what bothers you about that?
My pet peeve about energy waste is bus idling in New York City. It's against the law for buses to idle in New York when it's above 40 degrees. but they do it anyway.
What's your story at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org? Got some numbers for you now. Yesterday at the TED conference, an economist was making a comparison. Apparently, the global economy is about $55 trillion. The U.S. economy is about $14 trillion. But for one reason or another, it's estimated that $655 trillion in obligations and so-called securitized derivatives is out there in the financial market, waiting either to explode and take out the entire global economy or to be slowly sort of retired as we deal with this crisis. How did we get in that situation? What is the metaphor? Economists, policymakers are all struggling to come up with a metaphor for how the financial sector could get $655 trillion worth of debt when we only have a $55 trillion economy. Well, perhaps addiction is a decent metaphor for this. Joining us now is Dr. Gregory Burns, author of Iconoclast, a neuroscientist, reveals how to think differently. He also directs the Center for Neuropolicy at Emory University. Dr. Burns, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
How does addiction explain the kind of numbers in the financial sector that have so warped the global economy?
You can look at addiction really from two different perspectives. The most obvious one, and the one that most people are familiar with, is simply just by looking at behavior. So you ask yourself, I mean, what are the signs of addiction? Well, it's an increasing tolerance to whatever you're addicted to. So it doesn't matter if it's heroin or in the finance industry. I would say the finance industry has been addicted for a long time to increasing levels of risk and return. Now, what are the hallmarks of that? Well, you need more and more of whatever your drug is to get the same kick. So, you know, like a heroin addict, you would see in the finance industry an increasing tolerance of risk. So, you know, decades ago, it would be insane for banks to leverage their capital so highly. You wouldn't see people, you know, taking the risks that they have. But now, I mean, look what's happened. We have leverage ratios of 20, 30, or 40, and you see banks like Bank of America, whose value is essentially going to zero because of a very rather small proportion of their assets being bad, but because they're so highly leveraged, you know, it's worthless. Now, the other way you can look at it is actually a little bit more interesting, I think, which is what actually happens in people's brains when they get addicted to something. Now, one thing that we've learned from neuroscience is that the brain uses probably what we call a common neural currency to signal value. And that has a lot to do with the dopamine system, although we don't know the exact details of that. It seems that it doesn't really matter what motivates you or what kind of reward you pursue, whether it's money, whether it's food, whether it's sex, or whether it's heroin, it all seems to flow through the same parts of the brain. And we're just beginning to understand the conversions between these things. But what we do know is that...
I definitely want to hear the sort of end side of it, but, you know, this addiction to risk thing confuses me a little bit because it seems for the longest time there was almost no risk in these transactions. There was a lot of profit, but it seems like there was sort of the idea of risk, but it really wasn't risky in the same way that a gambler who's addicted is at the roulette table knowing that at any moment they could lose everything. Where's the dopamine come from?
Well, as you were saying that, it reminds me of many things that drug addicts have said to me as well, which is, you know, I have the thing under control. There's really no danger. I'm not going to get addicted to it. I think it's an illusion. You know, people get lured into the complacency because there's no immediate consequences, because indeed the risk was passed on to third parties and fourth parties and so on. But ultimately, it's still there. And it's not like people in finance have the inability to make those calculations. I mean, clearly they do. I mean, they can calculate it. It's just that they choose to ignore it and delude themselves into believing that really it's not that risky, but in fact, you know, it's an increasing tolerance to it. It's like kind of a slippery slope.
So what is the sort of takeaway here? I mean, do we now have a set of warning signs for this happening again, or do we need to worry about rehab for the entire banking industry and how long they're going to be in it?
I think we're into the rehab phase. Well, actually, I don't think we're even into the rehab phase. I think we're in the intervention stage at the moment, where the patient is still in denial. I mean, think about it. So the TARP program was essentially, you know, giving a small dose of heroin to the heroin addict and say, here's a little bit of heroin. We want you to manage your addiction and get well. And, you know, we know how well that's worked out.
Well, by the end of this, I suspect the dollar is going to be about as potent as methadone in terms of, you know, helping the economy. Isn't the rehab profile here a little more urgent than, say, for a drug addict?
I would say so. And, you know, like any good addiction program, the first thing the patient has to do is admit that it has a problem.
And we might not be there yet. Dr. Gregory Burns, thanks so much. Gregory Burns is author of Iconoclast, A Neuroscientist Reveals How to Think Differently. He directs the Center for Neuropolicy at Emory University in Atlanta, where they're thinking about addiction as a model for what's just happened to the financial industry. And now headlines from Mark Garrison.
Thank you, John. We're coming up on 21 minutes before the hour. President Obama is keeping his focus on the economy this morning. Last night, the president slammed critics of his economic stimulus bill. He says they need to come up with some new ideas.
Don't come to the table with the same tired arguments and worn ideas that helped to create this crisis.
Senate moderates want a deal to cut out with a lot of new spending, including education and health funding. Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell says his party is not giving up on getting a leaner bill passed.
Those discussions have been going on, and we'll continue them throughout the evening and maybe well into the weekend until we can get some kind of consensus here about what is the most appropriate thing to do to help jumpstart our ailing economy.
Also, later this morning, the president will announce a team of outside experts to his Economic Recovery Advisory Board. Their goal, among other things, is to fix things in the economy. The board will be headed by former Fed Chair Paul Volcker. A congressional panel is warning that the government overspent bailing out financial firms. They say the Treasury Department paid almost $80 billion too much. One recipient, insurance giant AIG, got $40 billion, even though their assets were thought to be worth only $15 billion. Now to Africa, where Zimbabwe's President Robert Mugabe is set to amend the country's constitution. This clears the way for opposition leader Morgan Tsvangirai to become the country's prime minister. The signing of the bill moves forward a power-sharing agreement that's been stalled for many months, as we've been watching here on The Takeaway. Adora.
Thanks very much, Mark.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Adora Udoji. And all week we've been talking about energy in our Power Trip series. And today we thought we'd drill down into some of the water cooler wisdom, I say that with quotes, surrounding energy. And we're going to do some myth busting with Matthew McDermott, who is an alternative energy writer for treehugger.com and planetgreen.com. Welcome and good morning, Matthew.
Welcome. Thanks for having me.
A lot of listeners wrote to us, called into us, wondering about office buildings, you know, leaving the lights on all night long.
Sure.
And some people wondered whether or not you actually conserve energy by leaving the lights on versus turning them off and then turning them on.
Right.
True or false?
I would say false. The main thing is, I think that probably came out of the myth that there's a small surge of energy that when you flip on the light. And the thing is, that exists, but it's so minuscule that it really has no effect on it. If you're going to be leaving the room, shut them off. I mean, there have been studies that have shown you can save significant amounts of energy by shutting the lights off at night. It's a simple step. And granted, there's some places that people are working all night, so you may be thinking that they're just leaving the lights on, no one's there, but you should shut them off.
So truly, our listeners are right. All those lights on is just wasting a ton of energy.
If nobody's working, yes, 100%.
Okay, how about cloth diapers? Are they better than disposable?
That's a more complicated one. Yes and no. Depends on depends on where you are. There have been studies done that show that cloth diapers and the disposable diapers, actually, the amount of energy it takes to launder the cloth diapers is about equal to making and disposing of the other ones. So it comes down to where you live. If you're in an area that has severe water stress, say in California or the West Coast someplace, you're probably better off going with a disposable biodegradable diaper rather than the cloth, because you're using more water and energy to wash them. But if you're here in New York City or someplace where water isn't such of an issue, Maybe the cloth ones are better because the disposable ones are going to take an awful long time to biodegrade.
Oh, that's so interesting because you certainly hear people say, no, 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 don't use disposables because they're plastic.
Right, right. It's definitely an issue that's based on local circumstances.
Okay, and how about washing dishes? Is it better to wash dishes or to run your dishwasher?
We just looked at this one at Triago, actually, and again, it comes down to how many dishes you're washing. If you're using an entire load of your dishwasher, that's far more efficient in terms of energy usage and water usage than washing by hand. However, if you're only doing one or two, you can probably get away, you know, with less energy and less water doing them by hand.
Okay, so fill up that dishwasher.
100% fill up the dishwasher. You're going to save energy.
And speaking of filling things up, this one was actually a stunner to me, which is the freezer more efficient when there's more things in it? And the answer is yes.
It is indeed.
Explain that.
It is indeed. From what I gather, it's more efficient when it's full because all of the frozen items in it actually help it maintain the temperature.
Uh-huh.
So once everything's up to that cool temperature, I should say, down to that cool temperature, it maintains the temperature better.
Matthew McDermott, thank you for joining us this morning and busting a few myths for us on energy.
Thank you very much for having me.
Matthew McDermott is an alternative energy writer for treehugger.com and planetgreen.com. So you got a few choices. If it's a few dishes, wash them in the sink. If it's a lot of dishes, put them in the dishwasher.
You do.
And turn those lights off.
Definitely.
Thank you.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Friday, and it's February 6th, and Mark Garrison is in for Femi Okay with the headlines.
Thank you, Adora. Coming up on 12 Minutes Before the Hour, The Way We Were by Barbara Streisand, the number one hit of the year 1974. We bring it up only because that is the last year unemployment was as bad as it is now. We just learned last hour that it's at 7.6%. That is rough and actually even worse than expected. You'll probably hear that number a lot today if you listen to senators wrangle over the economic stimulus package. The last Guantanamo Bay trial is on hold. Charges against an al-Qaeda suspect in the 2000 USS Cole bombing have been dropped. 17 American sailors died in the Yemen attack. That was the last active war crimes case at Guantanamo Bay. President Obama ordered freezes on all trials for review. The Pentagon says new charges against the suspected bomber can be brought later. He will stay in prison for now. This afternoon, the president will meet with families of the Cole bombing and 9/11 attack victims. Some families have protested the order to halt Gitmo trials, saying they've waited long enough for justice. Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg is recovering from treatment for pancreatic cancer yesterday. The disease is one of the most dangerous cancers, in part because it's often not caught before spreading to other parts of the body. In this case, doctors say they removed a small tumor after spotting it in a routine checkup, and they caught it early. Ginsburg survived colon cancer 10 years ago. In Pakistan, nuclear scientist Abdul Qadir Khan has been released by the High Court in Islamabad. That's according to his lawyer, A.Q. Khan, was put under house arrest in 2004 when he acknowledged his involvement in the illicit nuclear technology trade. He confessed to selling secrets to Iran, North Korea, and Libya. He later retracted the confession, saying it had been made under pressure. Adora.
Thanks very much, Mark. As Mark indicated, employers eliminated almost 600,000 jobs last month, the most since the end of 1974, catapulting the unemployment rate to 7.6%. All told, the economy has lost a staggering 3.6 million jobs since the recession began in December 2007, and about half of this decline occurred in the past 3 months. The new numbers mean finding work is a big challenge for anyone who's looking. Today, we're going to take another slice of this story and take a look at what that means for migrants. Joining us now is Dimitrios Papadimitriou, president of the Migration Policy Institute. He's recently written a report on the issue, and we welcome him from Washington. Good morning.
Good morning, Adora.
In the past, when economic times have gotten tough, many migrants have headed home. But you found this time around that's not happening, right?
No, it is not happening. And the past that you're referring to is the very distant past. Typically, you know, in the last two or three times that we had a serious problem, which was the early 80s, the early 90s, and the early 2000s, people essentially stayed put. And, you know, they stayed put for very good reasons. They had a support network here. They were hopeful that they would be able to, you know, sort of survive that particular downturn. And they had an expectation that the recession was going to be short-lived.
So what is happening now? And does it depend on which country that immigrant may have come from?
Yes, to a certain degree, it depends on the country they came from, and it depends on the status of the individual, whether they're here legally or illegally. You know, people who come from, let's say, developed countries, Canada, Europe, and all that, and there are a lot of people who are here illegally from these countries, despite the fact that we're focusing only on illegals from the region. These people are probably better able to sort of wait it out because they tend to work in the top half of the American economy. So they probably have savings and they have a bit of a network. The people at the bottom half, which in a sense typifies people who come from the region, Mexico, Central America, have a much deeper network, but they earn much less, and the sectors in which they typically are employed have been hit very hard with this recession. And the recession for them started about a year and a half ago rather than a year ago. Think of the housing sector, think of some of the hospitality sectors, et cetera, et cetera.
And how do you expect this to evolve if, as many economists say, the economy just keeps getting worse and worse?
Well, they are going to have to face some very unhappy dilemmas. If indeed this continues for a long time, survival in the United States may be much harder than survival back home. And then it all depends on public policies and, of course, on how deeply the recession hits their country of origin and their particular hometown. So, you know, if we assume, for instance, that, you know, Mexico and Central America will suffer as deeply as we are suffering, or perhaps more so, I suspect those people will try to wait it out here as long as they possibly can. But there may come a point where there are nothing but Hobson's choices, bad choices for them. And we'll see when we get to that point how they will react.
And speaking about choices, an interesting point that you make is one of the reasons why many, particularly illegal immigrants, are unwilling to leave is because it's so much harder now to get back into the United States.
Very much so. You know, however we, you know, want to paint the picture at the border, the fact is that the costs of entry into the United States are much higher today than they were a few months ago, and they were much higher a few months ago than they were a year ago. We put many more resources over there. The probability that you may die in attempting to cross is very high. And, of course, the probability that you will be arrested and pushed back and again is increasingly high. So they will put that into the overall calculus, that if they leave, they are probably going to have a much harder time trying to get back in.
What would you like to see the Obama administration do with this kind of information you provided in this report?
Well, I hope that, you know, the administration, when it gets to focus on these kinds of issues, focuses on the fact that, A, we do not need to marginalize people who are already at the margins of the society any more than we have to. So we have to make sure that we don't contribute to additional divisions in the society. For people who are here legally and do not have access to some of the social benefits, perhaps we should just give them access because they came here legally, circumstances changed, and now it's for us to think hard about that. We did that, incidentally, with children's health insurance only a week or so ago, And perhaps we should consider doing that with the rest of the legal population. With people who are here illegally, I don't have any particular advice except to look at other countries that are already experimenting with this same issue, such as Spain, that is trying to give, you know, incentives for people to go back.
Thank you very much for your insight.
You're quite welcome, Adara.
That's Demetrios Papadimitriou, president of the Migration Policy Institute, telling us about his recent report on migrants here in the United States in this tough economy. John?
Well, immigrants certainly make up a large component of that 600,000 in the unemployed rolls that were announced today. So before we go, Adora Udoji is here with a final personal headline, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, there is a personal headline. This is my last day for a little while. I'm going to be off for 2 months on maternity leave because my husband, Ron, and I have adopted a six-month-old little girl.
That is big news, which brings up a takeaway.
Hey, Adora, this is Patrick Henry Bass. I'm calling from Brooklyn, New York, just to say how much I hate not being there today with you and to thank you for all you do for the Takeaway listeners with your amazing voice and wit and how much I'll miss you. But I know you're going to be so happy you're Ron with Siobhan, and I look forward to seeing both of you really soon and listening to you on the Takeaway when you return in April. Take care. Bye-bye.
Oh, Patrick, thank you.
And that's not all.
Uh-oh.
Hi, Adora. It's Jim Ellis, assistant managing editor of Business Week, and I'm just calling to offer my congratulations as you head off to maternity leave. You know, this is sure to be the most challenging assignment of your career, but it's also the most rewarding. But don't get too used to the mommy track. Your listeners need you right back here on the air.
Oh.
So hurry back.
I love these. Thanks,
no
Jim.
No more calls. We have a winner.
Hey, Adora, it's Todd Zwillick with Capital News Connection in Washington, and your sometimes fill-in host buddy when John Hockenberry's away. Hey, I'll miss you between now and April. I'll miss your tough questions at 6 in the morning. But hey, instead of getting up to talk to us at 6, you can get up with your brand-new daughter. How about that? We'll see you in the spring, Adora.
Those are great. Thanks, you guys, for collecting those wonderful thoughts. I appreciate it.
Congratulations, you and Ron and Siobhan. That's a family.
That
good
is
luck.
A family.
You've got a great adventure coming.
You missed two little furry things, though. There's also Max and Listy, the pooches.
That's right. They have no idea what's about to hit them.
They correct. Don't, John. They really
<That's>
don't.
So thanks to all of you for following our Shovel Ready project, which is on the Takeaway website, and also the West Coast Power Trip series covering the future of energy. It's all on our website at thetakeaway.org. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Adora Udoji. And
this is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway.
Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.